From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 25th day of April, 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the cold weather with market analyst Wayne Nelson at agmarket.net and the impact it's not really had in Chicago. And we'll also take that same weather up with Don Day at Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Along the way, we'll hear about a brand new book that Scott Irwin has just authored and released. It's a great book about the commodity markets and a bunch of stories from his lifetime. Then as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the ethanol market too. That with Dan O'Brien. He's with K-State University, and we'll do all of that on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
May corn for the day settled at 646.5. It was down 4.75. July at 607.75, a quarter higher. And December futures up 0.75 at $5.48.25. The May beans 20 lower at $14.45.25 a bushel. November at 12.66, down 10.75. Bean meal 4.70 lower. The bean oil 85 cents lower. Soft red winter wheat, July contract down 4 at 653. The hard red July at 803, down 14.5 cents. Live cattle futures, 52.5 cents lower. Feeders, 17.5 higher. And lean hogs, down 30 cents. The wholesale price of gasoline, 4.5 cents lower, 256.4. And crude oil, down about $1.56 a barrel. Wayne Nelson at agmarket.net now joins us to talk about the marketplace on a cold day. Looks like it's going to be a cold week and a half to 2 weeks now, Wayne. I think the planters are just off to the side. Farmers may be watching the markets. What did they see today?
They saw a lot of red. It just wasn't a very pretty day, except maybe for gold at the end of the day, corn up a quarter of a cent. But basically, it was one of those days where we were pressured by mostly dry Midwest weather outlook, a lackluster demand, technical selling, negative outside markets, new lows being set for the time like that, nine-month lows for corn. Wheat, the lowest since 2021. Soybeans and cotton, one-month lows. We looked at some pretty good planting progress, but don't look for it to continue on this for next week and the week after with the temperatures we're looking at. So it was one of those try-to-catch-a-falling-knife-if-you-want-to-be-long type days.
Is this the kind of day that opens the bottom up to the marketplace? I mean, is there support here, or have we made it through that?
Well, that's sort of the question that everybody's asking. And I'll tell you what, as we read the news wires, there's great discrepancy in what they're thinking. Some of them just say, we're open up to the bottom. We haven't found support. Others are saying this is no place to sell because it looks like we should be finding a bottom here soon along the way. One of the things, though, that we are looking at is Brazil. Bean harvest is over 94% done. It's basically finishing up here. Their corn base has started narrowing back in down there along the way. And, one of the problems they've had is storage problems. They didn't have room for it. And as they finish up, they don't have to sell immediately or take the very wide basis. So we look for some stabilization in the Brazilian crops. But, boy, they're so much under ours right now that they're not really a stabilizing factor on the downside either yet.
What are you telling producers when they call in? Anything in particular, or are they asking you questions?
Well, that's sort of a good question, Todd. But the answer is, I guess, we're not aggressively negative right here. We thought today would be a turnaround Tuesday. With the weather, like we've talked about here in the degree days and maybe the planting isn't, you're not going to get a lot of maturity by planting today compared to the middle of next week. And I think just the cold weather is going to be a little bit that might help stabilize this, because I think there will be some farmers out here that the planting progress won't be quite as far along as they thought it might be next week.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Wayne, and look forward to having you and Kurt Kimmel and Greg Johnson with us for Commodity Week on Thursday.
Looking forward to it, Todd.
Indeed, that is Wayne Nelson. He is with agmarket.net. We're going to pause today to take a little bit of time for something completely different. Scott Irwin, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, has just written and released a book called Back to the Futures, Crashing Dirt Bikes, Chasing Cows, and Unraveling the Mystery of Commodity Futures Markets. It's a great book. I think you should buy one. It's actually in the number one bestseller group on Amazon right now. It was released last week, and you can pick it up. Just search Scott Irwin's name out, and you'll find Back to the Futures there. But first, let's talk to Scott about why it is that he put this book together. I asked him just that last week.
Because I'm crazy. A little evident from the book, I have to admit.
Actually, that's more of a serious comment than you might believe. In all seriousness, I just really needed to do something different, Todd. It's just kind of the cycle of my career. Every 5-10 years, I've always needed to take on some kind of new big challenge. And I'd never been sitting around just thinking, oh, I need to write a book. That's the next thing. And it just kind of happened starting about 6-7 years ago. I started thinking about it, and then a concept came out, and then I decided to really do it.
You did this in cooperation with Doug Peterson, mm-hmm. who worked at one time in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, along with me, actually, in agricultural communications. How did you find him?
Well, it's an interesting story. Doug's one of my dearest best friends in life. We have been meeting together for lunch once a week for almost 30 years. And so we do that routinely. And he's a professional writer. And so we're always talking about his projects and a little bit about ag economics. You know, it's boring to most people. And so just learned a lot about, you know, writing and publishing from him. And we never talked about me writing a book, but I got an idea, you know, that I need this new challenge. And it really came out of one of my favorite authors is a writer that's pretty well known named Michael Lewis. And he writes a lot of books on sports and economics, business statistics topics. And he has this format where he will personalize the issue in some way. And then he writes about the kind of harder technical stuff. And then he goes back to a personal story. And just one day I was reading one of his books and I said, you know, I've always wanted to explain commodity futures markets to a broader public, but just didn't know how to, you know, get people to open the first page. And I said, I think I could do this. I have enough crazy stories in my life that maybe that'll keep it interesting and moving along.
And Doug probably took to this really quickly, I would think, with you, because he had written books on really blasé topics about soil science and such, and developed earthworms that were heroes. And I would think the two of you just had a ball putting it together.
We did. I was honestly surprised when I got the courage up to say, you know, well, I've got a book idea. You know, that's like a classic, you know, I've got a movie script. Everybody's got one of those in their head, right? And we kind of just walked out, laid out my idea. And he goes, you know, I think we could do this. We should do this. And I know I would not have gone forward if he'd have shot the idea down, because I was lacked a lot of confidence in a big project idea like this. And from there, the process was by far and away the most fun part of this. We've spent over 5 years putting this book together, and how we started once we said, well, we're going to do this. And fortunately, Doug had exactly this experience. We spent our lunch hours after we'd have a little brown bag lunch. He interviewed me for 2 years, and he recorded every interview. He has a written transcript of the notes he's taken. So we had all that raw material. And so it was basically just 2 years of him hearing wild and crazy stories that I know left him shaking his head. He said, like, he thought he knew his good friend, but he didn't until after this process. And so that part was really, really a lot of fun. And then, as I also like to say, he knows more now about commodity futures markets than any other average person in the world.
You open this book with and there are a couple of them, I think, in the book, but a near-death experience. And you were young. It has to do with the local elevator.
Right. So the opening scene of this book is when I'm 9 years old, and I always loved going to the local elevator with my dad. I liked, you know, that was kind of like a coffee shop kind of environment, at least in our local little Iowa farm town that, you know, that was a gathering place and farm, always some elderly farmers there drinking coffee and, you know, swapping stories and latest town gossip, whatever. But I was always fascinated by the markets. I don't know. It just hooked me from early age. And my dad was also, from his experience when he was younger, managing grain elevators before he started farming. He was, you know, more interested in the nuts and bolts and what's going on in the markets and the average person. And I really kind of caught that. And I caught it from just tagging along with him going to the elevator and going back to the what seemed like a secret room in the back where the ticker tape machine was. Just fascinated by it. So That started from a young age. And on one of our trips in October 1967, you can read the book to get the details. I managed to run in front of a Pepsi delivery truck and should have ended my life at that moment. And the irony, it was in front of the grain elevator, which I loved going to.
A couple of things about that story. I like the ticker tape. I think anybody who is at least as older as you and I are, maybe a little younger than that, will remember the big yellow ticker tapes. They were wide and just had a spinning wheel on them, and they would print all day long prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, the Mercantile Exchange, and news items. As a farm broadcaster, we used them as rip and read. Mm-hmm. We would rip the stories right off of them and read them on the radio. The other part, and I read this later in the book, is that, and really had never thought about this, but this is where you begin the story of commodity marketing, because the farmer comes, weighs the truck, dumps the grain, weighs the truck again to find out how much grain actually was on the truck. And then I always thought of it as a grain elevator receipt. It's more than that.
Right. The piece of paper they get is what's called a warehouse receipt, because almost every elevator that takes public grain from customers in a public way has to be bonded as a quote-unquote warehouse. And there's an extensive legal code about what a warehouse is and what rules they have to follow. And you get your ticket is literally a warehouse receipt, which ultimately feeds later into the book into a raging controversy about delivery and convergence in the grain futures markets that started about 06-07.
Yeah, so you use that first story much later in the book to talk about a story we on the radio talk mostly about as it related to wheat, but more commodities than just wheat were not converging at the time.
Oh, yeah. Everything was failing all at once, you know. It was just that the wheat failure of convergence was so spectacularly large that it kind of, you know, just overshadowed what was going on in corn and soybeans. But they experienced the largest failures that those markets had ever seen. They just weren't anywhere near as large as the spectacular failure in the soft red wheat contract in Chicago.
Why did you choose the Weld brothers to include in that particular story to give you that I have something in my background that I want you to know about that I think is funny, and that gives us a reason to talk about this.
Right. You know, every chapter begins with hopefully a funny or crazy story, but they're there for a purpose. My friend Craig Perong described them as market parables. They function as parables, and they really do. And in that chapter, several things intersect. One, I call my dad a gearhead farmer. It seems like the Irwin men have some kind of gene that loves speed. And I definitely inherited that from my dad. And I grew up in particular really liking to go to dirt track oval races at a place called Knoxville, Iowa. They run something called Outlaw Sprint Cars. And I still follow it and enjoy it. And there was a famous for that little world, family of sprint car drivers and builders out of Kansas City. And they were led by the patriarch was a guy named Taylor Pappy Weld. And, you know, this was pretty, back in the 1960s, this is a pretty rough and tumble kind of place. There's a lot of fights. And so they had a huge controversy at the national championship race at Knoxville one year in the early 1960s. And the Weld family, in essence, bent the rules. Didn't break them, but just found a way in order to get one of the family members back in the big race. And I use that as kind of the metaphor for what happened in that Grain Convergence episode, the chapter's titled The Market Finds a Way. And that, like the Weld brothers found a way around the rules to make it work, the same thing happened with Grain Convergence. It looked like the markets were broken, but in fact, they were not. They just had to find, the market had to find a way around a problem, which was that the storage rates that were fixed in the contracts were too low for those economic circumstances. And so the market had to find a way around.
And so this case, convergence, we probably should explain, is when the cash price at delivery, that's the last time the futures really trade the marketplace, so December futures for corn, should be really close to the cash price at the loadout facilities. In this case, for wheat, for corn, for soybeans, it was not.
Exactly. And for wheat, in September 2008, you had the Chicago wheat contract in the futures contract was expiring at a price that was $2 higher, more than $2 higher than the cash price of wheat at the delivery elevators. And, you know, everybody's looking at this going, the market must be broken because nothing like this had ever happened before. And, you know, it was a huge violation, seemingly, of, you know, a bedrock principle of which all commodity futures markets with physical delivery are based upon, which is at expiration of the contract, the cash and futures come together. If they don't, hedges don't work. And if hedges don't work, then the market really doesn't work. And so this was a huge controversy at the time. And then the book tells the story of how, along with some other colleagues, we dug in for several years trying to solve what I call the crime of the century in the grain futures markets.
It looked like a train wreck at the time.
Yes.
We talked about it like a train wreck at the time. I don't know whether there's a train wreck in here, but there is a good friend of yours who you are constantly in peril with. It seems like the two of you, just if there was trouble, you could get into it.
Well, you have to own the truth sometimes, Todd. And talking about the real star of my book was my best friend growing up, was a kid named Jack Hunter, still a dear friend. And as I like to say, the fact that we're still here, both of us, is proof that God has a sense of humor, because we, by all any reasonable analysis, the stunts we pulled and the insanity should have ended us a long time ago, probably before we were 16 even. And so, you know, by today's standards, some rather extreme reckless, dangerous behavior with cars, snowmobiles, motorcycles, go-karts. Jack was the type, then he went on to race stock cars for a while. And so that kind of tells you the personality.
And you use those stories in the book as well as bedrock for how you get to the commodity markets.
Exactly. All of the stories, again, are there with a purpose. And so the first third of the book is really about laying the foundations of what is a commodity and the basics about how a commodity futures market operates. And so to explain commodity futures markets, you have to explain what is a hedger and what is a speculator. And so Jack is my stand-in for a speculator. And my dad is, as a farmer hedger, is my stand-in for a hedger. And so that's what happens in that first third of the book.
Yeah, and in the first third of the book, you identify something that seems to have been within the farmers' minds since the development of trade, which that somebody was trying to rip them off. The speculator was after them. Certainly the elevator was working towards them. And you argue that none of that really is the case.
No, I mean, I've really spent my entire career mainly focused on that exact question. You know, are farmers getting ripped off by the grain markets from the futures through the cash, mainly the cash? The way I like to put it, I grew up in a typical Iowa farm family who a bedrock, assumption was that there were three someones that were out to rip off the farmer. It was the big grain companies, enemy number one, enemy number two, the USDA, form of the farm programs, and then the second were speculators on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade and Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And the conspiracy theories ran rampant as I grew up in the midst of that. And I'm sure that all of that kind of conversation, spurred my interest in just, is this all really true? And, so I've tried to just as reasonably and dispassionately as I can address those issues is what my career has been about.
What do you hope people that read the book get from it?
Number one, I just wanted it to be a fun and entertaining way to learn about commodity futures markets, the markets I've loved and studied my whole life. But on a little bit deeper level, what I really hope that people get out of the book is a much deeper appreciation, warts and all, for the crucial role that these markets that are generally kind of in the background play in not just the ag economy, but our entire economy.
I must admit, no matter whether you're involved in agriculture or you, for instance, listen through this program every day and wonder what language we're speaking sometimes, this is the perfect book for you. Back to the Futures, Crashing Dirt Bikes, Chasing Cows, and Unraveling the Mystery of Commodity Futures Markets, authored by Scott Irwin and Doug Peterson. It's available on Amazon. Don Day now joins us from Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Hi, Don. Thanks for being with us. Cool weather here in the Midwest this week. Can you tell me about conditions for the rest of the week and next week as we start into maybe the month of May?
Well, I'll tell you, May is going to start off very cool in the central and eastern part of the United States. A large trough is going to settle on in, and while we may not be looking at any what I would call severe cold, it is going to be persistently cool here for another week to 10 days. This will be true for most of the mid part of the nation, all of the Corn Belt, all of the Great Lakes, and the East. Now, after that, I do see a trend that is going to be bringing in some warmer weather, but it's going to be another 5-7 days of cooler than average conditions over most of the Midwest.
Is there any wet weather involved in that?
For some areas, for a large portion of the Corn Belt, we don't see a lot of precipitation. In fact, only the far northern areas of Illinois and Indiana and maybe parts of Ohio and northern Iowa will get some rain. And even those rain amounts for this time of year are going to fall short of average. It's actually going to be cool enough to kind of mitigate any significant thunderstorm activity, but this pattern is going to be wet, and some good news for some areas that we've been talking about that really need it. We are going to see some of the best rain in months across winter wheat country of western, southwestern Kansas, eastern and southeastern Colorado, the Oklahoma and Texas panhandles, all going to be getting anywhere from 1 to 3 inches of rain over the next 5 days. And that'll be the best rains they've seen in a long time.
Hey, thank you much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Don Day. He is with Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Each Tuesday, we take a look at the agricultural energies. This week, we're joined by Dan O'Brien. He's at Kansas State University with K-State Extension. Thanks, Dan, for being with us. I want to check first on some conditions in the hard red winter wheat growing regions. There are 9 counties, I believe, in western Kansas that are on track to be as dry as they ever have been. What are conditions like?
Well, those, I'd be surprised that it's only 9. Frankly, you know, when you look at the U.S. Drought Monitor, really almost all of Kansas except parts of east central and northeast are in at least severe, if not extreme, to exceptional drought. So, but again, that's a drought monitor. That's measuring soil moisture down into the root zone. You can beat a drought monitor number like that, as they have in Iowa in recent years, if you have ongoing timely moisture to supply the topsoil. But in those areas that you're talking about, we're probably acutely concerned about the wheat crop, as you'd mentioned. In a lot of cases, wheat had been these dry conditions, again, following the La Nina several-year pattern that we've seen, really slowed down production, damaged the production potential for hard red winter wheat coming into this year. We did see in some of those areas some emergence happened just within the last month. You know, not a very good situation. And our agronomists tell me that you still could make some decent wheat, you know, even with that distorted process for hard red winter, but you're losing yield potential down. If things are just sterling, just wonderful, are you down 25, 30, 40%, something like that? And as I drive around the state, you see a few places where you do see some decent looking wheat, but in a lot of others, I guess wheat's taken some the moisture that's gotten of late, but still you see really spotty, some kind of thin stands around. So, you know, for us, Todd, I think every year we always say, gosh, this is an important year for the Kansas Wheat Tour, but this is a really important year for the Kansas Wheat Tour. just because we'll have people out in the field, they'll have a chance to see where we stand. If we get some moisture in the next few days, is that enough to right the ship and turn things around? I don't want to just feed the prevailing pessimism in these areas, but if we do get moisture and it does come on, we're still looking at some constrained, we'll be polite to say constrained production prospects here it is in late April. By June, July, I don't know that we can recover enough to get to the point where we'd have 40 bushel per acre wheat in these areas. I think that would be a time of great surprise if we got that high. Will it be more like 30, 35, something like that, which is sharply lower than we have in most years?
Naturally, we'll be paying attention to what's happening with that wheat crop and cover the wheat tour, which happens in the month of May in Kansas, a few counties in Oklahoma as well, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Now, once a month, you take a look at ethanol with us, along with the Ag Manager website, agmanager.info, that belongs to Kansas State University. And I believe that you're telling an interesting story this time around related to ethanol, its usage, and potential demand over time. Can you start with ethanol prices? Since, what, about 2021, they've had a pretty high average price.
Well, yes, when you look since 21, the price of ethanol has had been, well, excuse me, we had been, in essence, struggling to get above $2 per gallon coming through about 2020. Since that time, ethanol has moved higher. We priced in a range of about 203 on the low end to 312. The 312 came in September 21. And we had dropped down earlier this year to just above $2 again. But now with a combination of factors, some of them international, as I think you alluded to, we're up to about 238. So you combine the 238 price that we've estimated basically for ethanol plants in Iowa, at least so far during the month of April, and combine that with some softening of corn prices, and you have a reversal, really, in terms of the financial prospects for ethanol plants in that region, and which is a bellwether for probably pretty close to what you're seeing in Illinois and is representative, at least, pardon me, for trends here in the Western Corn Belt. So by our numbers, we've gone from a loss of about 3 cents per gallon produced during the month of March to about a 15-cent profit here in the month of April. And after suffering for several months of below break even costs, I guess I'm sure for ethanol plants that's a welcome situation. No doubt, I think overall, and you probably see this especially in your Illinois area, there's optimism in the corn market in general for a return to regular moisture and at least a decent crop and for a decent U.S. corn crop this year, which would be of help for both the availability and moderation of prices for ethanol. So I think as you're looking out into prospects for the ethanol market this year, you've got both the price situation for product, what we're selling, the ethanol, and the input price, at least at this time, seemingly heading in directions that would at least give break even to moderate profitability for ethanol plants. So it's one of those things, the famous last words of an economist is, we shall see. We'll see if these trends continue.
And then you put that, can you put that into terms of what our capacity in the United States is like to produce ethanol and how much we're actually using?
You know, you'll always wonder, I try to follow the Renewable Fuels Association plant numbers for both capacity and number of plants, and to try to get an idea of plant utilization, and try to truth test that with whatever USDA numbers we can get hold of for that. And it looks like we've got a capacity at least the latest reported numbers in late April of about 17.9 billion gallons per year of production capacity. We've been averaging about 86-87% of total use of that capacity, and you might think that might be even more, but anyway, those are the official numbers, producing about 15.6 billion gallons of ethanol per year, which if we go back and remember all those discussions of the renewable fuels standard, that's not far off of where those numbers were coming at. So we've been, in essence, trending 2020 about 13.9 billion. Again, we had that COVID came in, et cetera, from 2021 to 15, even 15.2 billion gallons, 2023 projected for this year, about 15.6. And, you know, some optimistic news about E15 being accepted coming out of the EPA, the administration, current U.S. administration. So there are some things that are looking up on the positive side for ethanol. We're not talking here yet about the renewable diesel issues that are affecting also the other major side of the coin in the U.S. would be soybean supply demand balances. But so between ethanol and some of the positive things happening for it and some of the trends for bioenergy, you've got, I think you stand back and look at, you see, and for me, it looks like we have more domestic energy related usage in the U.S. for our major corn and soybean crops. And that, on the one hand, that gives us more surety of demand, a little less elasticity, more inelastic, which is a help for price in most cases. But it does add in kind of a policy-making element to the financial health of those sectors going forward.
Okay. And then as it relates to ethanol, you in the Ag Manager PowerPoint that will be posted to agmanager.info include a Kansas State supply and demand table for corn. And I thought your ending stocks for corn for the 23-24 crop, or the one that's being put in the ground now, was a pretty interesting number. Can you go through some of the consumption side of that and how you came with that up with that 1.88 billion bushel ending stocks number, which feels actually like a smaller number than most might see?
Well, we're in essence we're taking when you look at yields for this year, you either are using the USDA's 181.5 bushel per acre average, which gives you an over 15 billion bushel corn crop, or a something probably akin to the highest we've seen in the past, which is it looks to me like 177 is the highest we've ever been. At a recent USDA data users meeting, we had a strenuous discussion about that number. So I guess maybe, Todd, my Western Corn Belt drought affected perspective is coming into play. You know, I'm not as optimistic right now to go plug in a trend line number, 181.5 bushels per acre, 15.3 billion bushels of crop when a quarter or more of the Western Corn Belt is under dramatic drought. So you'd have to, you've got a real battle of the East versus the West in terms of the ability to hit that number. If you get that number, the 181.5, then you're probably going, do we get to 2 billion bushels carry out, et cetera? I'm not sure. So what I had done in essence to get that 1.88 billion bushel carry out, so take that actually is the USDA number, the 181.5, and then took from the Ag Outlook Conference what their supply demand numbers were, projected going forward for 2023, and came to 1.88. Basically, it's 1.9, almost 2. But if you plug in the 177 bushels, which is about a 14.8 billion bushel corn crop, then you're down to about 1.4, 1.5 carry out. So, there's a lot of difference between 1.4, 1.5, and 1.9 in terms of billion bushels of carry out and stocks to use. So you know what? I guess between you and I, as we watch these ag markets, that's what keeps us. I was going to say maintains our employment as we try to balance those issues and recognize that, hey, there's some real questions here that are going to be answered in the next several months.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Todd. Take care.
You too. Dan O'Brien is with Kansas State University Extension. Helped us to wrap up this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online at willag.org. Our theme music for the day was written, performed, and produced by Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.